Welcome to Luma Digest. I'm Noura. It's Wednesday morning, the 22nd of April, and today we're talking about something that costs teams weeks of work, causes 2 AM incidents, and happens because of conversations that never got written down, API contracts that break in production. Right, so here's the thing. The most expensive bugs aren't usually implementation errors, they're contract errors. A team builds an endpoint. The front end and back end agree on behavior in a Slack thread. And 6 months later, a field rename breaks a silent consumer. The incident postmortem always includes the phrase, "We thought this was backward compatible." And the thing is, they probably did think that. Most teams document what fields exist and what types they carry. The parts that cause 2 AM incidents are almost always the same three things. Error taxonomy. When should a client retry versus fix their input? Idempotency. Can a payment endpoint safely retry? And breaking change definition. What actually counts as breaking before you ship? Without these written down, they live in people's heads. When minor cleanup happens, an engineer makes a judgment call instead of checking a spec, removing a field that looks unused, renaming something that seems internal, both are breaking changes, or they're not, depending on who's talking about it. That ambiguity is what breaks production. So what's the fix? The difference between spec-first development and regular API development isn't the tools, it's the order. Regular development goes like this: build, document, ship, break a consumer, fix it. Spec first goes, define the contract, review the contract with consumers, build to the contract, validate in CI, then ship. That contract review, before code is written, that's where conversations about optional versus required fields actually happen. It's almost free at that stage. It's expensive after deployment. The minimal setup? Write an open API spec for each endpoint. Include what counts as breaking, removing a field, changing a type, making optional required, and what doesn't, adding new optional fields, new endpoints. Then run a tool called OISDIF in CI to catch breaking changes before they reach code review. 15 minutes writing a specification prevents a 2 AM incident. Think about that for your own APIs. Are the rules in people's heads or in the spec? Right. Completely different topic now. But this one properly surprised me. Meta has developed an internal tool that converts employee mouse movements and button clicks into training data for AI models. Not just recording for security or productivity tracking, converting into training data. So every time an employee interacts with an internal system, clicks a button, fills a form, navigates a menu, that behavior becomes part of the dataset that trains production AI. Now, I wasn't sure about this at first, because on one hand, real user behavior is exactly what you want for training models that interact with humans. Lab-generated data doesn't capture the messy reality of how people actually work. But here's what I keep coming back to. This isn't just about Meta's employees. If this approach works internally, what happens when it scales to external users? Are everyday interactions with apps quietly becoming training data? The consent question is obvious, but there's a deeper one. If AI models are trained on how people currently behave, and those models then influence how future interfaces work, what feedback loop does that create? We're not just training models on static datasets anymore, we're training them on live human behavior. And then those models shape the next round of behavior. Something to think about the next time you're clicking through an app. Okay, so this next one is technical, but stay with me because the implications are wild. Researchers have built a framework called Ares. It discovers dual vulnerabilities where both an LLM and its reward model fail at the same time, and then repairs both. Right, so let me explore that. When you train a language model, you often use a reward model to score outputs. Good answer, high reward, bad answer, low reward. The problem is, both the LLM and the reward model can be wrong in the same direction. The LLM generates biased output. The reward model thinks it's great. They reinforce each other's mistakes. Ares finds these dual failures and fixes them together. What's interesting here isn't just the framework, it's what it reveals. Allocation level fairness constraints, the rules we put in place to keep models fair, don't eliminate feedback-induced bias in retraining data. In plain language, even when you think you've made a model fair, the way it gets retrained can quietly reintroduce bias. And if the reward model has the same blind spot, nobody catches it. The takeaway? If you're using reward models in production, you need to test the reward model itself, not just the outputs it approves. Now, this one I keep coming back to. A new training method called EasyRL trains language models efficiently by starting with the easy stuff and working up to the hard stuff. Sounds obvious, right? But here's the bit that matters. It outperforms baseline methods using only 10% of labeled data. The approach is based on cognitive learning theory. You initialize the model with a few examples, Then you use divide and conquer pseudo-labeling on harder unlabeled data. The model learns incrementally instead of being thrown into the deep end. What this really means is, if labeling data is your bottleneck, and it usually is, you just got a 90% reduction in cost. That changes the maths for every team building custom models, smaller teams, tighter budgets, same performance. Worth thinking about for your own setup, right? Completely different corner of the tech world now. Quantum physics. Researchers have directly measured something that shouldn't happen according to classical electrostatic theory, like charged particles attracting each other over unexpectedly long distances. Now, I know that sounds abstract, but here's why it matters. Water molecules organize around charged surfaces in ways that create an electrosolvation force. Standard models don't account for this. So if you're building anything that depends on understanding how charged particles behave in solution, biological systems, battery chemistry, filtration tech, your models might be missing a fundamental force. The implications are still unfolding. But when experimental measurements contradict the theory you've been using for decades, that's the kind of thing that rewrites textbooks. And finally, one more from the web development world. Cloudflare just published a reference architecture for scaling model context protocol deployments. MCP is the protocol that lets AI agents interact with external systems safely. What Cloudflare is positioning here is centralized governance, remote infrastructure, and cost controls as production requirements for enterprise agent systems. In other words, if you're running AI agents in production, you need the same kind of controls you'd put around any other critical infrastructure. Who can access what? How much can it cost? What happens when something goes wrong? The takeaway? AI agents aren't experimental toys anymore. They're infrastructure, and infrastructure needs governance. If you're building agent systems, Cloudflare's reference architecture is worth a look. It's a blueprint for not getting fired when your agent spends £10,000 in an afternoon. So, stepping back from all of that, here's what I keep coming back to. The thread running through today is contracts. API contracts that break because the rules weren't written down. Training contracts between users and platforms that nobody explicitly agreed to. Reward models that need contracts about what fair actually means. And agent systems that need governance contracts before they touch production. Contracts aren't bureaucracy. They're the difference between assumptions and agreements. Between things working and things breaking at 2 a.m. Something to think about on the commute. That's it for now. Thanks for listening. Links in the show notes.